Good afternoon.
Welcome to I Only Read the Mountain Goat's Mail, the podcast where John reads his mail while I talk into a microphone.
That would be a pretty high concept. Although I think I've been misusing the phrase high concept my entire life. And at this point, I don't think I could learn to use it correctly. But I think I just mean conceptual. But anyway, yes, today I'll be reading some letters and reflecting on how blessed I am. No, it's a podcast, so we'll be talking a lot because, as we discussed on an earlier episode, I think, but possibly on a later episode, I'll have to check. Silence is pretty uncomfortable in podcasts. Nobody can be happy with a silent podcaster. That's the next theme podcast is the silent podcaster.
I mean, we've definitely, as we will talk about or have talked about, we're recording these out of order, so time's going to get a little weird.
What if the silent podcaster is a show where in the iTunes description It says our theme this week is bereavement, right? But every week it's just a half an hour of silence, right? And you actually do record it. You have a live mic and you can sit there and think about it if you want, or you would probably delegate it to somebody, you know, if you were busy or whatever. But anyway, somebody sits in front of a mic for half an hour saying nothing. You announce what the theme is. And that is, I like this idea.
Well, I think what you need, you also need to get celebrity guests that will then sit in front of the mic. You know, you get like Chris Evans or very famous movie star to come into a studio and sit quietly in front of a mic for 30 minutes.
So. I think you would actually get more and better celebrity guests than anybody else if you were legit about that. If you were going, so I'll explain this to you. Neither the producer nor the writer of the podcast, such as it is, may even be there. You will be alone.
We will provide you a microphone.
We'll provide you a microphone. You come into our offices, which are lovely. There's a pot of coffee. But your job will just be to sit, and you can reflect or not reflect. You could probably just look at your phone, and I bet you would have, like, you know, giant A-listers go, please let me do the silent podcaster. Everybody tells me my ideas are bad.
I'm Joseph Fink. Welcome to I Only Listen to the Mountain Goats, the show where I talk with John Darnielle, singer and songwriter of the band The Mountain Goats, about good podcast ideas involving silence. This season, we are going song by song through John's 2002 album, All Hail West Texas. Today, we talk about the song Distant Stations, and later we will hear a cover recorded just for this podcast by the legendary Andrew Bird. But for now, it is August in Durham. John and I are in the Merge Records office, having upgraded from recording in his basement. We are in the world's squeakiest chairs, and you will occasionally hear employees of Merge in the background, because we were just kind of tucked into a busy office on a workday. That setup aside, we rejoin the conversation right where we left it. I would argue that generally people like your ideas.
Like, no, the ideas that I actually do something with, they like. The ideas that I pitch tend to more closely resemble this, or like my... You know, I was telling anybody who cared to listen for a couple of years that I was going to write 1,000 poems, and that was going to be a book I was going to eventually ask my publisher to do was my 1,000 poems. Mm-hmm. I think everybody would say, "Oh, I'd like to read your poems." You might like to read 100, and you might like to read 200, and if you were really feeling it, you might go for the third 100. But I think once you looked at the 1,000 page poet, you would say, "John, that's too much to ask of a person." 1,000 poems, all of them about speed metal. It didn't actually write the speed metal variations, as it was going to be called.
So we're going to talk today about Distant Stations.
Right.
But first I wanted to talk about the title of this podcast. I Only Listen to the Mountain Goats, which is a phrase you sell on shirts.
Yes.
Where did that become a phrase that became part of your band?
It was an idea I had for a sticker. You know, nobody said it, but... I mean, there's a few things it's based on, including a family friend when I was a child who only ate Kentucky Fried Chicken. Mm-hmm. There was a guy from Indiana who was a friend of the family. But my grandmother invited him over for, like, Thanksgiving or something like that. And he showed up and he sat down. And my grandmother put, like, you know, she was a lady from Arkansas, born in 1896, so she put out like a 7-course deal. And he looked anxiously at my father and said, "Max, you didn't come. He said, "Well, I'll be back." And he got up and he drove to Kentucky Fried and he came back with a 2-piece. And that's what he ate. And my grandmother was so shocked that she couldn't even say anything about it. And that kind of purity it, like, that's the only guy I've ever known who's actually like that, right? Mm-hmm. I know people who claim they only listen to one style of music, but you catch them, right, listen to something else. There's nobody – you may go through a period in your life where you only listen to ambient or metal or whatever, but generally speaking, people like a little variety. But I sort of like the idea of having made music that at some point somebody has to say – so say, hey, well, hey, have you heard the new Hiss Gold Messengers? Well, I would, but I only listen to the Mountain Goats. To me, that's funny. The Mountain Goats starts as a kind of funny project. You know, mm-hmm. there's humor in it, and even though I like wind up writing about a bunch of serious topics, and part of it is the grandiosity of a guy calling himself the Mountain Goats, right? So there's always been a little tad of the bit of the grandiose. I think I told you my my solo appearance bio that I use.
No.
Oh, I'm pretty proud of it. it's a litmus test. If people don't think it's, if people like get mad about it, then you can tell they were already going to be mad. It is, if I do a solo appearance, I may have stopped using this, but John Darnielle is the singer and guitarist for the Mountain Goats. Literally everyone in the world loves the Mountain Goats.
I mean, it's a good bio.
The thing is, it's not true at all, right? But sometimes when you listen to something you really like, it does feel that way. Like, it's the only thing you want to hear. For me, with Earth, Wind, and Fire, when I listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, I go, why is there other music? There's no reason for there to be other music than Earth, Wind, and Fire, right? Same with the second Merciful Fate album. You listen to that, and I go, I don't need anything else. I'll tattoo it on my arm, right? Don't Break the Oath. That's the only record I need. I like that feeling. I like to think that we make music that occasionally for people is gives them that vibe.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting phrase because it is both an expression of complete enthusiasm, but it is also, as you said, kind of its own joke because no one only listens to one band.
That's right.
I don't think – I mean, I'm not going to say no one, but there's very few people in this world that will only listen to one band, you know?
Very few. But there are some bands that inspire that kind of thing. I mean, the Beatles, there's people who I suspect listen to the Beatles so much more than they listen to other stuff that they might as well only be listening to the Beatles. Sorry, I was seeing if any of those metal poems were any good, but they're not.
Would you like to do a poetry reading?
I was thinking about it, because I like to read poetry when my poetry if it's good, but I think most of these are like way too obscure. This was one called Screaming for Vengeance. Pale historians gather at the conference of Rose in her room. They calculate the angles of forearm and bicep. She's on her stomach, atop the print bedspread, an enormous colorful poster on the wall adjacent. These are the hours, still in dispute. No way in. Flaked stone tools. Does anybody recognize that poster? No. Nobody then. Nobody has yet identified it. It seems there is still the question of the poster.
I mean, that's a very good poem.
Thank you. I like that I'm never going to finish that project. It's like, it's there as a concept. I'll probably write about a half dozen more of those at some point. I will fall approximately 980 short of the actual 1,000 goal. So.
I mean, the beauty of a lifelong project like that, one you will never finish, is it really demonstrates it as a project that is only for yourself. Because it is work that is about the work.
Well, true. That's right. But although the thing is, like, I have another project like that that I should be doing instead of writing poems, which is finishing the handmade Sunset Trees, right? When the Sunset Tree came out, I sort of, for a number of albums, I kept assuming I was about to go back to civilian life, that I was going to stop touring and maybe make fewer records, maybe only stop altogether, who knows, you know? And the Sunset Tree was the third album on the 480 contract, and I was assuming, I hadn't seen any sales figures, but my assumption was that we were not going to be invited back for a fourth because our original contract had been for three albums. So I made the album I wanted to make. I made an album that I felt was important for me to express. And I liked the demos, and I asked him, would you guys print up the demos on vinyl and ship them to me in blank sleeves, and I'll decorate them all by hand. Right? We'll do an issue of 1,000. Mm-hmm. And I did the first few hundred pretty rapidly and took a bunch of them out on tour with me. But 2005 is when my life goes from being partly about the Mountain Goats to almost entirely about the Mountain Goats. And I never finished them. I have a couple hundred left in the basement. And I look at them from time to time. Every once in a while, like every 2 years, I'll get out the paints and the collage materials, and I'll do about 8 or 12 of them, and I'll go, wow, I'm tired. And I got other stuff I want to do. It's like, so I already have my permanent project.
What do you do with the ones you finish?
I take them out on tour. And I, Trudy sometimes has them in a special box. Trudy, who sells stuff for us, in a special box. If she sees somebody who she thinks might be somebody who'd want to buy one and would keep it and listen to it. The problem with these is that as flippable items for eBay, they're really valuable, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sell them for a lot of money. They're $25. I think they were $15 the first time I went out with them, like, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. So now they're $20 or $25 or whatever. But the probability is so high that a person buying it is not going to be able to resist getting $400 for it. And can you blame them? Right? You cannot blame them. But at the same time, people will say, look at Trudy and go, my friend in Boston has been looking for one of these for 10 years, and I really have to buy this for him, so I got to buy two, one for myself. Is that okay? And I like the chances that that second one is on eBay within an hour. So yeah. It's like, you know, it'll make you cynic. But I don't. I still do the same thing. I put them in the web store, or I take them down to my local record store. I go put them on the rack and let them go where they're going to go. So
let's talk about Distant Stations. It's a very listen, it's a Mountain Goat song, so a lot of this is true about a lot of them, but I think especially this is a very word-packed song.
Yes. There's one sentence that just spills out super fast.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a couple lines where it just runs over the syllables of the song, quite a bit. I don't know, I don't have a question there, I just...
Yeah, well, so it starts, it doesn't have a predictable meter, right? It has roughly trimeters in the first couple lines, I think. I wonder how, I've never actually counted it, but, you know, it's da-dum, da-dum, dum, da-dum, da-dum, dum, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. They're probably actually like 6-beat lines that are being split up, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't have a vivid memory of writing it, although, as I think I've said before, I'm pretty sure I wrote this one in the bedroom as opposed to out in the living room, which to me, like, that's a vibe I don't think I can explain, that the ones that were written in the bedroom, there were so few of them written in there at this time, that they are the sort of the closer, more intimate sounding ones to me. And this one, I think, is a lonesome little song. It's got that that feeling. I mean, for one thing, it's a person addressing somebody who we don't know who it is. We know it does sound like they're not in this person's orbit anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? That somehow or another. I think when you remember having been taught something, you don't give yourself that space until the teacher's absent. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't say, you're the one who taught me that, unless some time has passed, you know. And I also like it because it's not a love song. And like we've talked about this before, that on this record and on The Coroner's Gambit, I'm starting to really move into songs that try and inhabit a special mood that's apart from the complaint of the lover or stuff like that. I mean, I had been doing that all along, writing songs about, you know, emperors or whatever, but I think this one is like a human being confessing some emotional moment that doesn't concern romantic rights and wrongs and stuff. Is a little rarer in, mm-hmm. in folk and pop music than, you know, than it ought to be, I think. So,
yeah, I mean, it's certainly not all of our lives is devoted to that, but it is
the
preponderance of our art.
It's a lot, and I like that. I mean, I love. I'm not saying I'm not programmatic. I don't say well, there's enough love songs. I don't believe that, but at all. But I like that you can't. I like that you can't really say what's going on, but you can locate the mood.
Small prayer for the poor and the naked and the hungry, and I prayed real hard for you. never told you where I was. It was you who taught me how to write this kind of equation. I waited on the steps for you, and I hid in the bushes whenever I saw a car pull into the parking lot. You taught me how to listen to these distant stations. Distant
There's something about the chorus that in my head felt a bit like a like early 90s alternative song. Like I could hear it with Nirvana style electric guitar.
Soul Asylum, yeah, yeah.
There's just something about the like two word basically chorus followed by this chord change that felt.
Yes. Well, and that's unusual not only for the Mountain Goats, but for this song. The song is sort of logorrhyic and then it goes, I waited for you, right? And there's a little, suddenly it lets in a little breathing room.
Yeah, I mean, which is, we've been talking quite a bit, I think, this season about the idea of breathing room in songs and leaving space.
So it bears a resemblance to some of these 90s alt-rock songs, which is that's a really good musical observation, I think. It's not something I was thinking about, but it does have this little breathing where you, I mean, normally you would listen to how the band gets to the next chord in that. There is no band here, there's just me and my guitar. But there is a little... We talked about this with respect to a different song, listening to the chord movement a little bit instead of just the vocal, and instead of just, you know, getting out of the way a little and letting the chords sort of have their own voice in the song, you know, which is why it's good that Andrew's the guy doing it, because he's, you know, a guy who often lets the music speak, you know, instead of just saying, well, there's a musical background for me to do stuff over, which is how I start. I start making music just to put words onto.
Mm-hmm. You know, you have this chorus that is sort of defined by this gap.
Right.
But it's also talking about the whole idea of distant stations, this idea of a thing that is defined entirely by this...
By distance, yeah.
By this, yeah, this emptiness between you and it, which is actually why, I mean, in a lot of ways, this feels the most, not just Texas, but specifically West Texas
right.
the songs, because it is... This idea of radio stations that are somehow coming to you from a very long way away is very, it's the desert, you know?
Well, we've talked about driving through Texas, right? That like, that's one thing that you notice in Texas, and you especially used to more when radio was, you know, when it was either radio or cassettes, right, in your car, and those were your options, right? And so you know, if you're driving all the way across the country, eventually, you know, either you run out of cassettes or you grow tired, you get curious, listen to the radio. There's parts of Texas where you go, you know, if you leave the radio on, you notice that your station died, and then you drive for a long time to see how long it is before anything happens. Because if you're doing scan, when it goes over through twice, you go, wow, there's nothing, right? But then there's these blowtorch stations, some of them, there was one in Tulsa that broadcast out of Kane's Ballroom, which is a club you play at in Tulsa. That's one of my favorite clubs in the country. And they had this blowtorch station that was broadcasting like 30,000 watts or something like that, 50,000 watts, you know, that was audible down in northern Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a miracle. And that's something you know, it's an idea that's hard to imagine in the age of the internet, of like trying to get a frequency to hear something from far away. Useful metaphor for me. So.
And in Texas, they really believe in the very powerful radio signals.
Yes.
My co-writer, Jeffrey Craner, has shown me in Mesquite, Texas, near Dallas, the local radio station's tower.
Right.
And it looks like, I mean, it's just like...
like a tower on the moon, right?
Right. It is several stories tall. It looks like a military installation. Awesome. And that is the local community radio.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, you need it because it's like there's long, unpopulated areas. And like if you have a flood warning... You want somebody 50 miles away to be able to get it. I mean, these days, again, every place is wired, though that's not true either. I really relish when you're going up the California coast. I have no reception. I can't see nothing. It's like really kind of cool. But yeah, there's an interesting dynamic in the lyric of the guy saying, I waited for you, but I didn't tell you where I was, which is, of course, I mean, that's a, it's the kind of relationship dynamic that makes for bad relationships, where you say, well, you know, when one person wants something from another but refuses to say what it is mm-hmm. he or she wants, that's very unhealthy, right? It's really not, you know. But who hasn't been in some relationship where somebody says, you know, you should have said this, and you go, you didn't tell me what you wanted. You know, it's, well, I shouldn't have to tell you, people say,
right? Yeah.
Okay. And then you get into that sort of R.D. Langian knot, right, of you know, it's a very unhealthy starting and ending place. There's no way out of that. It's a knot, you know. And this is one of my narrators who, that's your clue that this guy is in some way not unreliable, but most singers of songs, speakers within the narrative, you're just going to assume that I can roughly trust this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But you know he's a person who has a pretty unhealthy dynamic working somehow or another, right? So, you know, I think that informs the elegiac tone of the second verse, that you know, he presents himself as a guy who's very concerned with his with this person who's missing, but he's forcing them to fail at something.
Mm-hmm.
So,
anytime, I mean, this isn't a relationship, but I think maybe it's also kind of in, just with anyone in life, that anytime you ask a question that you need from them a specific answer, or yeah. you test them in that way, then you're just setting both of you up to fail.
Yeah.
Because people aren't going to recite the script you have in your head.
This is why, again, Latin and Greek are great, because there's ways of asking questions in Latin or Greek, like specific particles that you can attach to verbs, I think, or nouns, I forget which, that indicate to the person listening that you're expecting a yes. So, or a no, right? There's a, and I remember seeing it in the textbook where it says, you know, whatever word it was, and then, spoken expecting the answer yes. And I was like, that is brilliant. That's great. I mean, it's like we do that also with uptalk and stuff. We say, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, you want to go to the store? Right? And that particular inflection means, don't you want to go to the store with me? Right. And like, but it's not, you know, it's interesting. We do it more with tone than with words.
I mean, well, we also, you just used actually the word that we use for that, which is right. If you are like, do you think it's this way, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
That tells us you're expecting.
No,
a yes.
Exactly. It's a telegraph.
You're never supposed to say no to a right.
No, right is not even really a question anymore. It's a punctuation mark. It's
yeah.
like I can't remember which. I think it was Barry Sanders, my professor at Pitzer, who I picked that up. Probably say, you know, say where he would say of Chaucer, he would go, "It's a riff, right?" And he's saying, "Is that not right?"
Yeah.
Is that have you not noticed this? If you haven't, let me assert that it is the case. Right?
Yeah.
So,
shifting back to distant stations.
You see, Joseph sees me trying to go. Can we talk some more about Chaucer? If you wanted,
I'm not going to be able to provide much input.
Well, no, I mean my Chaucer stuff is pretty rusty at this point. There's not much more I can do besides talk about the apology at the end. Most people don't take seriously, but I do.
Chaucer apologizes at the end.
My heart grows weak. Chaucer retracts the entire book he just gave you and the rest of his prose also. Well, but what he does, he says, I want to retract all of these works and all of these works and the Canterbury Tales, Thilk that sowen into Cinna, right? Which he means he can't bring himself to completely retract the Canterbury. He says, well, the ones that might make people sin, I'll take those back, right? But I think what he means is like, I can't really, these are too good. These are too good for me to apologize entirely for. Everything else he retracts except for his religious stuff.
What is it about that makes you take it seriously where others don't?
Because I think artists owe people an apology. I think including myself, I'm sorry for the stuff that I have made. I mean, if it's useful to people, then I'm glad, you know. But I think there's a sense in which all artists should begin from the assumption that, like, you're imposing yourself a little bit on people, and it's a little, you know. I mean, art is weird. Art is a very weird thing to do, to presume that you have something to say that is of value, you know, that's worth the time that people are going to take to listen to or read it. If you ever reach the point where you go, oh, I know for a fact this is of value to people. I mean, I'm very scared of getting to that point. I don't want to get to that point. I know that people might like it, but I want to proceed from the assumption that anybody who listens to me or reads me is doing me a favor, right? I don't want to feel entitled, you know. And I think Chaucer's attitude there is a good one, right? I think it's good to look very skeptically at the value of your own work. Not at the work itself. I think he probably liked his works a lot, but he thought, well, you know, what good are they really doing in the world? It's a good question.
Hello, Joseph here. I have two books coming out this year. Seriously. May 11th, 2021. The first 10 years, two sides of the same love story. So there is a love story that happened behind the scenes of Welcome to Night Vale between me and Meg Bashwinner, MC and tour manager for the live Night Vale show. In this memoir, we recount the first 10 years of our relationship, year by year, without consulting each other beforehand. It's a funny and romantic story about how differently we experience and remember our lives. Then on July 20th, 2021, The Halloween Moon, my first ever novel for ages 10 and up. Esther Gold loves Halloween, until the year that Halloween night just won't end. Even she doesn't want Halloween to last forever. No matter your age, if you are a fan of what I do, I think you're going to love this book. Get these books wherever you get your books.
Andrew Bird is an incredible musician and songwriter. I first saw him in Santa Barbara sometime in the early 2000s, opening for Ani DiFranco, and I can still vividly remember his set. Unfortunately, scheduling was difficult for this conversation with Andrew, and as it happened, the only time that worked for John and Andrew was when I was in transit home from a Night Vale tour of Australia. So our producer Christy hopped on with the two of them and nudged them toward a conversation about their work and this song.
I've always, you know, really responded to, like, the narrative in your songs, and it's something I don't actually do myself very much, but I always respect, like, admire it in other songwriters who can tell a story. And so when I got asked to do this song, I chose Distant Stations. What drew me to that song is that, you know, it's in 3.5 minutes, how much of a character development can you really do? And so there's this, like, sort of little hints at it, and then you're left as a listener to kind of fill in. You know, I have a lot of questions, but I still have a very vivid idea in my head. I picture this young person, and tell me if I'm on the right track, but I picture I'm not sure what the age would be, maybe 15, young, kind of in a small town, raised religious, but then meets someone who's enlightened or connects over some sort of shortwave radio and other scientific curiosity. And there's a bit of an obsession going on, you know, hiding in the bushes. But, I'm inferring this from just little hints, you know.
I love that. I love that. That's, what I do is hints is the thing. It's like, it's actually, now that I write books, it's different because you sort of have to pay the reader back for if you have a chapter where you have a bunch of really cool sounding hints and everything sounds like, you know, like, oh, this, what could this be? And like, that's where I live usually, is in the asking of the questions, right? Mm-hmm. I don't, in songs, I don't feel obligated to pay off or to have a payoff, right? I like to ask the questions and open up the space. And then I sort of feel like that's how lyrics talk to music, is like you sketch a little something, and then in the space that the musicians or that the chords make, you sort of get a bunch of potential answers, right? And then the listener can infer all manner of stuff. And I like that. I like it as a big open space for play without a definitive yay or nay. Although the thing is, people do sometimes say, well, you know, I thought that the character in this song was, an astronaut. And I'll go like, well, I don't know where you would have gotten astronaut from in there. It's like, if you like, sure, you know. But yeah, so in this, I mean, this is one of sort of when I was realizing that that's what I liked best was, like, you have a guy in a motel parking lot and, you know from his personal pronoun that he's staying in the motel by himself, right? It says my motel room. And he throws a rock, you know, and thinks about somebody. That's kind of all that happens in the song, right? Right. And he has a little prayer, and he names a couple of cities that seem to have some personal connection to him, and they're pretty disparate. One is an expensive L.A. town, you know, and the other one is Albuquerque, which, you know, is sort of... I like Albuquerque, but I remember when we were trying to find it on the first tour I ever did to Southwest, we were stopping. This is pre-Google Maps, and you know, stop and ask some old dude for directions. And he said, "Were you trying to go to Santa Fe or Albuquerque?" He said, "Well, Albuquerque." He said, "Well, all right, Albuquerque is a big, ugly, crappy, dirty town." And I was like, "Okay, well, thanks. That's where we're playing today. So if you could just tell us." But like, it is a big, you know, sort of a, it's the big hub town. And so yeah, I mean, that's all that happens. And what exactly is going on with the guy? I don't write from a place where I say, here's the thing you're supposed to figure out. I paint a sort of blurry picture in the hopes that people bring something to it, and it sort of resonates in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I like when songwriters give the listener credit for having an imagination and some intelligence. And then I thought to myself, why would a 15-year-old be staying in a hotel by themselves? But
but it's a good question, right? Because then you could have a whole story about that. I like that. I mean, to me, it's like I never really thought about the guy's age. I think there's a personal flaw of mine, actually, is like when I have a character in a song, he could be 15 or 55, and I'm probably never going to give you any clues on that.
Right. When we made the recording in Tucson at a local community radio station, I can't remember the call letters, but it's in that townhouse outside, just in near downtown.
Yeah.
And because we had a session there, and then we kind of said, okay, we got to knock out this song.
Right.
So we recorded it straight to CD. It was not the most flattering room, so I was pushing really hard to sing. But what I wanted to get with that song, and I'd been thinking about lately, is, you know, singers that do a sort of half-spoken, half-sung delivery. I remember going to see Leonard Cohen on his last time around, and there was all these, you know, highly orchestrated songs and singing. And then he stopped and he just recited one of his classic poems.
Man.
It was like when your third grade teacher breaks from the program and tells you a story about their personal life and you're just rapt, you know?
Yes, yes.
When they switch the mode from all intoning and melody and start telling a story, like we as humans are just like, oh, that's a story, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And so Lou Reed, Jonathan Richman, you know, the different singers that do that, somehow it gives the narrative a little more teeth. Like just it gets traction as a listener. And so I don't know if I really successfully accomplished that in it, but I was thinking about, you know, Modern Lovers. I was thinking about Lou Reed and that kind of, you know, Street Hassle, that kind of delivery.
That's super interesting. I was just thinking about Lou Reed, as I do a lot, because when I was a kid, when I was 14, he was my absolute number one dude, right? He could do no wrong in my book. And I had tons. I would buy bootlegs and everything. But as is always the case with any artist you kind of worship, now I kind of have a lot of resentment about Lou Reed. Like now I like, you know, when I hear people praising the sort of the, you know, it being more about feel than about playing. Well, I'm kind of more into bands that can really play these days, right? Even though I myself will never be a great player, that's what I really respond to a lot these days, is like, you know, the sort of the deftness of session guys and stuff like that, right?
Right.
But for me, but Lou is a big touchstone. But Jonathan Richman, on the other hand, I feel like is the trickier version of that, because he does sort of sell you on this idea that it's like, that he's sort of just shooting from the hip, right? You know, that he's just giving you whatever was right there on his plate. But if you see him play, that guy can play his ass off. That guy is an incredibly good guitarist.
I know. I think he's just devoted to, I mean, both Lou Reed and Jonathan Richman similarly, like, just live and breathe it and devote themselves to. But yeah, he's like he belongs to the Classical Guitar Society in his town, and like, like studies classical guitar, and his rhythm playing is amazing.
And yeah, his rhythms are spectacular. That's the thing, is like you listen to Jonathan Richman album, and there'll be 16 songs, and they're all 1-4-5 grooves, right? They're not they're not, you know, not big complex numbers, but they all sound different because he's approaching it from these different rhythmic styles and stuff. I feel like he's still underrated. You know?
Absolutely, absolutely. I've gotten to spend some time with him lately, and we started playing. It's maybe the beginning of a project here, but we're like playing classical pieces that we really like together, but playing them kind of like folk tunes.
Oh,
like, oh, this is how this goes, you know. And
man, if you got any practice tapes of that, I'd love to hear that. That sounds amazing. My I have a huge affection for him personally, because he made space for us when we don't have a rehearsal space. So when we go out to tour, usually we have like 2 or 3 days to find some place to play together and get ready for the tour. And the first couple shows are usually pretty patchy.
Yeah.
And Local 506, the club in Chapel Hill, was managed by my, or owned by my manager's husband, so we could use that sometimes. But he had a show that day, and we showed up to rehearse, and he was there. And we were like, hey, we were going to rehearse here. He goes, oh, yeah, no, we only need to start our sound check around 4. We just got here early, so we're up on stage. You guys, I'll remember this on my death. So you guys practice hard, and I'll see you when we get back.
He's awesome.
So you're working with him. That's really, I'm hugely jealous. He's
I had him on my show as a guest, and we spent the whole day together just kind of geeking out. And now he'll just call me at night, like late at night, on his landline, because that's all he's got, and say, hey, I just want to stay in touch. I want to make sure, I just want you to suggest a piece that I could learn, and then we could, so we're trying to keep the fires burning because there's a connection there. He's a new friend.
Super hip. No, that's the but yeah, that conversational style, it's funny. I don't think I really do that anymore. I didn't renounce it or anything, but it was totally a big part of what I did for the longest time. And Distant Stations is one of those where the line lengths are sort of, they're variable in the way that when you talk in a conversation, sometimes you have a long sentence and other times it's just a little something, but they're all inside of a rhythm. I love that you got this song.
It's funny when I'm like singing some of those lines that have the run-on sentence that you got to squeeze in before the next bar, how suddenly your hand gestures become very New York, like you're just, you're just kind of tossing it off and casually, just to and cramming it all in there. But yeah, I'm kind of fascinated by that. So you bridge the gap between songwriting and writing long or narrative, novels. And I'm always, every time I read a novel, a decent one, I'm like, man, that's impressive. Man,
should give it a shot. You could do it.
I enjoy writing prose, but I need to be an assignment. I need to be prompted. But to keep the threads of all these different narratives going, and like that requires a lot of discipline. And we can get away with murder in our 3.5 minute songs, because what is this medium good for except to just kind of raise a couple interesting questions and then.
Sure, and get a good hook in, and you set a mood, and it's more about feelings. There's a lot of feelings in books, but in songs is like so much, especially in a in a verse chorus verse bridge type song. You're zooming in on a feeling. It's like if you get the feeling right, everybody will not mind that your details were or weren't good. If you get good details, that's good too. But in a book, you have to both have the feeling and the structure. Whereas the structure in a song is accounted for by the music mainly. The lyric is there to sort of do something the music can't, I think, and that's sort of give a very specific anchoring.
I found an old rock in the dry dirt outside the door of my motel room. It was a triangle with soft round edges and a split down the middle of one corner. It was darker than English moss, green like the soft frills of a peacock's plume. I waited for you, but I never told you where I was. It was you who taught me how to write these kinds of equations. And I waited on the steps for you, and I hid in the bushes whenever a car pulled into the parking lot. You taught me how to listen to these distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations. saw the sky break. I threw a rock at a crow who was playing in the molds of some rose bushes by the motel office, and I missed him by a good yard or two. And I sing old songs from nowhere, Los Angeles to Albuquerque. I said a small prayer for the poor and the naked and the hungry, and I prayed real hard for you, and I waited for you. But I never told you where I was. It was you who taught me how to write these kinds of equations. I waited on the steps for you, and I hid in the bushes whenever a car pulled into the parking lot. You taught me how to listen to these distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations.
Distant stations. I waited on the steps for you. Distant stations. These kinds of equations. Distant stations. The naked and the hungry.
If you liked the cover by Andrew, you can buy it wherever digital music is sold. The money from that track goes directly to both the artist and this show, and we really appreciate it. The full album of every cover from this season is available for digital and vinyl pre-order in the Merge Records store. The special release will be two LPs, one pink and one blue. Link in the show notes. Head over to IOnlyListenToTheMountainGoats.com to see the logo shirt, plus the logo tote, and of course the I Only Listen To podcasts about the Mountain Goat shirt, because why would you ever listen to another podcast? Check out the newest album from the Mountain Goats, Goths, which is out now. John Darnielle also writes novels, like Wolf in White Van, a book that the New York Times called a stunning meditation on the power of escape. I have two novels out, written with my Night Vale co-writer Jeffrey Craner, like Welcome to Night Vale, a book that NPR called a splendid, weird, moving novel, and about which Patrick Rothfuss said, "I think this might be the best book I've read in years," a compliment I'm still wrapping my head around. I Only Listen to the Mountain Goats is a production of Night Vale Presents with Merge Records. It is produced by Christy Gressman, editing by Grant Stewart, mixing by Vincent Cascione. All music courtesy of the Mountain Goats and Merge Records. Thank you to Christina Rentz, Ryan Madison, the Darnielle family for letting me intrude on their lives, Andrew Bird, the staff of Night Vale Presents, and Christy Gressman, whose voice was edited out of Andrew and John's conversation. But trust me, that it's as focused as it is because she's there. Check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows, like our upcoming Pounded in the Butt by My Own podcast, the first podcast by foremost writer of love and erotica, Dr. Chuck Tingle, featuring words of wisdom from the doctor himself and readings of his works by a cast of celebrity readers. This will be the show that lights your loins and sparks your heart. There is a short intro episode out now, and full episodes are coming soon. And remember, I waited for you, but I never told you where I was. Thanks for listening, and hail Satan.
Hello, iPod broadcast listeners. My name is Meg, and I am one of the esteemed tri-hosts of the beloved iBroad Good Morning Night Vale. I, along with my hilarious friends, fellow Night Vale actors, passionate eaters, and soft-hitting journalists, Symphony Sanders and Hal Lublin, are now over 100 episodes into our deep dive recap show of Welcome to Night Vale. We've tackled topics like soft meat crown headcanons, Cecil's fashion, and whether Steve Scones were really all that terrible, plus behind-the-scenes stories from the Night Vale creative family. And we've heard from listeners like you about queer representation, Night Vale named pets, major theories, minor questions, and of course, best and worst practices for alternative spa therapy services. If you know, you know. Check out Good Morning Night Vale every other Thursday, wherever you get your iBroads, iCasts, PodBroads, and podcasts. I think I like PodBroads the best. I'm a real PodBroad myself.